Hello, hello, spooky friends, and welcome to the Spooky Scunny Podcast, the podcast that explores everything funky, paranormal, criminal, and just plain weird about the state of Wisconsin. First, it's been a minute since I uploaded an episode. There have been a few reasons for that. Obviously, the last episode that I put up was about police brutality and violence against Black, Indigenous, and people of color. And I wanted to let that sit out there longer before kind of diving into something else. I also, in the middle of all of this, moved and, working in public health, it's gotten very busy with the fact that Wisconsin is now number two in the nation for coronavirus infection. So work is busy. And this is also the time of year when a lot of the extracurricular nerdy things I do, committees, research things, what have you, decide to meet. So it's just been an interesting few months. And I figured that before I had anything work related to do today, maybe I would sit down and record an episode. Because I don't know about y'all, it's election day, I could use the distraction. The first thing I want to address, other than all of that, too, is that you may notice my voice is very deep. And I'm pretty sure everybody knows, but probably not every single person. I don't know. I don't know how much you research into my life. I am trans, specifically trans masculine, so I am on testosterone and have been since January, which means we're coming up on, at the end of November, it'll be 11 months that I've been on testosterone, and that changes your voice, so enjoy listening to the soothing sounds of a very deep voice for me while we explore the history of tuberculosis in Wisconsin, specifically around the Lakeview Sanatorium. So the Lakeview Sanatorium is located in Madison at 1204 Northport Drive. I will get to what it is now. It is owned by the state, and you don't trespass. Like, please don't. There is a park behind it. You can go explore that, but you don't trespass. You will get in a lot of trouble. And first, I want to touch on the history of tuberculosis in Wisconsin, and then we'll get, closer to current day. Sound good? Cool. I'm just assuming you said yes. If you didn't, whatever. You can pause. Tuberculosis is a chronic bacterial infection. It travels through the air. It attacks the lungs and sometimes other internal organs. Patients with an active form, with an active form of tuberculosis may feel weak, have a loss of appetite, have a fever, chest pains, night sweats, a persistent cough, and even cough up blood. This is for those of you who have seen like Moulin Rouge. This is what Nicole Kidman's character has. It's also called consumption. Typically in any like old-timey movie, if they're coughing into a handkerchief and it's bloody, it's tuberculosis. It's also possible to be a carrier for the bacteria without displaying symptoms or be an asymptomatic carrier. Any of that sound familiar? No? Okay. It's all very similar to coronavirus, with the exception, obviously, of tuberculosis being a bacteria. So something that, like, antibiotics can fight versus a viral infection, which viruses generally have to kind of play out their course. And that sucks. I'm going to go into a little bit more about, like, the history of tuberculosis, but also, like, for those of you who really want to, like, dig in deep to tuberculosis or really any sort of pandemic, epidemic level condition, infection, etc., really great podcast called This Podcast Will Kill You, run by two lovely epidemiologists named Aaron. Yes, they're both named Aaron. And they do a really great job of talking through not only the biology of conditions and how they work, but also, like, you know, the history and sharing patient stories, provider stories, things like that. So it's a really, really great resource and something I nerd out over all the time. They also, for those of you interested in learning more about coronavirus, have multiple episodes on, like, the latest updates with that, etc. So it's a really great resource. It's also just really nerdy and I love it. Okay, so let's hop in a time machine. We're gonna go back to the late 1800s. By the late 1870s, there were concerns that cases of tuberculosis were increasing in Wisconsin. Physicians had identified the need to gather information about the number of cases, their locations, patient ages, fatalities, etc., to better understand the effects of the disease. That is what epidemiology is kind of like collecting all of that data so you can analyze it and figure out from a public health standpoint, like, where is the spreading more, or are there connections between the people that are getting it, that kind of a thing. It's really cool work. Really cool work. That it can also help, like, start to look into viable treatments, which is pretty cool. Up until 1882, the cause of tuberculosis wasn't known. There were all sorts of guesses as to what it was. So things like soil moisture, climate change, not wearing enough clothing, all of that kind of stuff really percolated around tuberculosis specifically. A large component of health professionals believed that it was somehow genetic. But in 1882, Robert Koch, K-O-C-H, I'm going to call him Koch because it's funny, discovered the cause of tuberculosis was a bacteria called tubercle bacillus. And the medical community was finally like, great, like, how do we treat this? How do we limit exposure, etc.? There were a number of people who weren't convinced by this, though. And there were a number of people who even thought, like, well, so maybe bacteria is a cause, but it's not the cause for everybody. Which is dangerous. And, you know, at this point, nobody knew how to treat this. We just knew it was a condition. So with all of this, like, confusion or naysaying around, like, if the bacteria was even the thing that's causing this, people also just didn't focus on how to treat it like a bacteria. The State Board of Health here in Wisconsin continued to support treatment through purity of air and removal from all special causes of irritation to the lungs, and the general upbuilding of the system by nutritious diet with relief from overwork and from depressing anxieties. The first statistical report on the prevalence of tuberculosis was presented in 1894, and it went into, well, I'll just read this snippet. For the year ending September 30th, 1893, according to the reports received from 593 localities in the state, 622 deaths occurred from consumption, and for the year ending September 30th, 1894, from 648 localities, 903 deaths are reported. It is impossible to estimate the exact number of deaths that occur from this disease in the state at the present time. Statistics in relation to these are of the most vital importance, as it is now recognized that this is one of the preventable diseases with which we have to contend. So it became very obvious very quickly that they needed to do something about this other than just collecting things. All of this, as well as advocacy efforts from individuals and organizations, eventually led to the State Board of Health in 1902 recommending the establishment of a state sanatorium for the care and treatment of patients. In 1904, the Milwaukee County Committee on Tuberculosis was organized to, quote, address the question of the establishment of sanatoria for the treatment of consumption, end quote, and to organize a campaign for the education of the public regarding the contagiousness of the disease and the curability of consumption in the early stages. Reports were prepared, and by 1908, there were three small sanatoriums in Wisconsin, accommodating a total of 100 patients. The oldest was River Pines, a private hospital that opened in August of 1906, located on the Wisconsin River near Stevens Point. The second was Blue Mound, located on the outskirts of Milwaukee, which operated as a philanthropic institution. And the third was a publicly owned and operated Wisconsin State Sanatorium near Wales. The three struggled to remain stable financially and operated at maximum capacity at all times. They mainly provided care for very difficult cases, and there was a need for isolation of those cases to help stop the spread of infection. But they also needed a ton more patient beds. I mean, 100 beds over three locations, when you know that there are far more deaths across the state, is just not that helpful. Advocates developed a plan to address the need by establishing a system of county sanatoriums. So an establishing act was necessary for these counties to set up the facilities, and then a bill was developed and presented to the 1911 legislature to, quote, permit counties to build and operate county sanatoriums for the care of advanced cases, end quote. This bill was signed into law by Governor Francis McGovern on June 27th, 1911, as Chapter 457 of the statutes. The establishment of the Wisconsin County System for Treating Tuberculosis Patients was unique compared to most states. We tend to do that with a lot of things. As a result, the majority of our facilities were built utilizing county funds and operated by the counties with only minor financial aid from the state. The quick construction of the Greenfield Hospital, Milwaukee, was based on rushed planning and design and just did not go well. There were a lot of problems that led to that negatively impacted the ability of this facility to function. In September 1911, the Wisconsin Anti-Tuberculosis Association, they had a publication called The Crusader, and they published a report outlining a planning approach and architectural design for a model county sanatorium. So well thought out was the design that it was adopted at once by several county boards. Indeed, most of the 17 county sanatoriums that opened over the next 20 years were basically built on this plan. The importance of implementing the county system in the state was underscored with the onset of the Great Depression. Yeah. As unemployment and homelessness rose, ideal conditions for spreading tuberculosis escalated. So the sanatoriums played a major role in caring for those struck by the disease and in limiting the spread of, how many people in a small contained location were getting this. The Wisconsin Anti-Tuberculosis Association also published posters and brochures that helped provide information about the services provided at the sanatoria. Beginning in 1907, a small group of men began to work towards the eradication of tuberculosis in Madison specifically and like the surrounding area. So they formed the Madison Tuberculosis Association, or MTA, as I'll probably call it, in 1908 and established a campaign around public education and doing a survey around the prevalence of the disease in the area. About 200 cases were identified pretty quickly. So members developed a plan to build a sanatorium focused on curing and preventing the disease in the Madison area. Charles H. Vilas, a famous philanthropist and doctor in the area, helped contribute funds to purchase land and build the Morningside Sanatorium. This served as the only facility of its kind in Dane County until Lakeview was opened in 1930. Soon after its establishment, Morningside was unable to serve the quantity of patients in the area. So thus began the push to erect an additional sanatorium, which would become Lakeview. Finally, in 1928, the Dane County Board committed to construct a sanatorium with 100 beds to serve the community. In order to determine the design and location of the facility, there was like a building committee. They had to choose a site and, you know, all those kinds of things. They wound up choosing Westport, so the area of the city that I've already mentioned that I lived in a bit ago. And it was unanimously endorsed. They felt like that area had a lot of desirable attributes. It was kind of in the center of the county. It was really close to Madison. And then it's a beautiful area, right? There's a lake right there. There's a lot of natural habitat, woods, etc. In the 1940 annual report, they actually mentioned that the site was unequaled from an aesthetic standpoint. So it was like way prettier than any of the other sanatoria. Here's a fun quote. "The highland on which the sanatorium stands not only provides the best atmospheric conditions available, but presents a beautiful view almost unsurpassed in the state of Wisconsin. From these premises, the eye may wander the wooded hills in the west, over almost all of Lake Mendota to the university buildings, to the dome of the Capitol, which always presents itself above the skyline of Maple Bluff, to the city of Madison straight to the south, and more to the east, a typical Wisconsin pastoral landscape." It is said that John Muir, the naturalist, in walking from Madison to Portage, paused on this hill to feast his eyes on the superb vista, which he believed his last view of Madison. That's pretty cool. So they purchased this property from Henry Harbor or Harbert. Names are fun things, and historical, trying to find like the correct pronunciations and spelling of historical names is interesting. So Dane County purchased this land. The original appropriation of $250,000 for construction had to be expanded by an additional $225,000 to complete the project. So it wound up costing about twice as much as it was supposed to. The construction firm of J.P. Cullen and Sons was hired to construct the facility. When the building opened in 1930, it was undoubtedly at that time the leading structure for the treatment of tuberculosis in the Middle West. The facility included every modern convenience and equipment for the operation of the sanatorium, for medical care, surgical care of the patients, all of that good stuff. The main building was completed and ready for people to move in on June 1st, 1930. Funny enough, as soon as that happened, they actually like moved somebody in the day before. So on May 31st, 1930, the first patient was admitted. And then they also built a power plant on the property that year. This is not something that's strange for sanatorium, like, use. They tended to treat them a lot like self-sufficient areas, because once you caught tuberculosis, especially at this time, they didn't have a cure, they didn't have treatments other than, like, be in a good area and get a lot of outdoor air, like... So one of the things that was really important was to make a self-sufficient area. So bigger sanatoria, you know, in areas like, I think, Kentucky, areas like outside Philadelphia, often had not only their own power plant, but like a garden and, you know, maybe a tiny farm and a post office even. This one was not big enough to kind of go that route. And the population of the area wasn't big enough to go that route either. But, it's really a common thing to see if you are going to visit, like, former sanatorium grounds, to see all of the different buildings and all of the different things that it took to actually keep that sanatorium self-sufficient and running. It's really interesting. If you've ever watched, like, Ghost Adventures or something like that, they actually visit a number of sanatoria and, like, talk about that. I can't remember the episode right now, but there's a specific one I'm thinking about where, like, there's red brick buildings. It also, like, served as a poor farm, which the Lakeview one did not, but it's a poor farm or poor house. Basically, if you were destitute, if you didn't have any money, they would also send you either to the sanatorium or close to it, because you could be housed there in exchange for things like tending the garden or working in the post office. So that tended to happen for a lot of sanatoria, especially as tuberculosis became less prevalent. Or, like, during the Great Depression, especially, too. So, the name Lakeview was selected because the view was pretty great, and there's a lake right there. Like, the hill is... Well, the hill puts the ground floor of the sanatorium on the same level as the roof of the state capitol. So it's about 150 feet above the surrounding countryside, which does really give you a really pretty view of the area. So Morningside Sanatorium continued to operate in Madison, and as Lakeview opened... you know, they were both admitting children. And then during the 1941-1942 fiscal year, Lakeview decided that they were not going to take children. And that's switched to Morningside's job. So Morningside became kind of like the sanatorium for children. And then Lakeview was the sanatorium for adults. By this time, the treatment of tuberculosis had changed a lot. So it became less about just sitting outside in good air and more about experimental things. There had to be numerous changes within the physical structure of the building. You know, like, the ground floor had a really big playroom for kids, and the fact that they weren't taking kids anymore, like, they had to do some upkeep and some redecoration and renovation. Also, the porches on the third and fourth floors didn't have roofs because sun treatment was a big thing. So you would sit on the porch in the sun, breathing outside air, and that was supposed to help you. But at this point, like, they're like, well, that doesn't work. Also, we live in Wisconsin. Maybe we should put some roofs on here. This following bit is quite a large quote from a review of the facility by the first superintendent, Dr. W.C. Ranking. "When the superintendent and medical director took charge of the institution in spring of 1930, he found a splendid up-to-date building, very effectively planned and embracing all modern features for the care and treatment of tuberculosis patients. Those responsible for the selection of the site not only chose wisely from a practical point of view, but located the most beautiful and delightful spot that could possibly have been obtained. From the point of view of the patients, the elevation, the outlook over Lake Mendota, and the immediate surrounds are ideal and conducive to recovery. The hospital building not only has a desirable abundance of floor space for each patient, including ample porches for the majority of the patients, but also an exposure to light, air, and sunshine that permits each patient to receive the maximum of these valuable necessities for recovery. The builders also made liberal provision for every form of treatment known to medical science, good examining and treatment rooms, a well-planned and equipped operating room, solariums and lamp rooms, facilities for direct sunlight treatment, a children's playroom and a schoolroom, occupational therapy department, and the finest and most up-to-date X-ray installation obtainable. Also a laboratory, treatment rooms, and everything the most exacting physician might desire are provided. The arrangement of having an available porch connecting with almost every room so that patients' beds might be moved in or out is a feature enjoyed by very few sanatoria and is a large factor in the recovery of patients. In short, the location, well-planned building, and fine equipment should place Lakeview Sanatorium in the front rank, not only Wisconsin, but the whole Middle West." At this point, right, the medical treatments for tuberculosis were extensive bed rest, exposure to fresh air and sunshine, and then like a diet consisting of a lot of meat, fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, dairy products. I mean, we are Wisconsin. We can't leave out the dairy. Patients joked about getting fat at the sanatorium, and in fact, it was actually a goal of the facility to help them gain weight, because a lot of them had gotten emaciated and very thin from the effects of the disease. Former patients often talked about how good the food was and how they were offered like a large amount of food, like at every sitting, which is pretty dope when we consider the fact that like most inpatient things, it's not that way. The emphasis on fresh air and sunshine meant the building site design and surrounding landscape were considered vital factors in the recovery of patients. Throughout Wisconsin and indeed the U.S., the movement focused on the treatment of tuberculosis applied a similar approach to emphasizing the location and design of sanatoria to maximize exposure to fresh air and sunshine. And indeed, the superintendent is right. If you look at other sanatoria, you know, people had to be put into wheelchairs or stationary chairs and sit out in a common porch area, as opposed to at Lakeview, you had to kind of like wheel out your bed from your room and hang out on the porch that way, which is pretty dope. Wish I could do that, but it's like 25 degrees outside. By 1933, there were a number of cost-saving techniques. They started growing a garden to offset the cost of fresh produce. They started operating a dairy plant to bottle and pasteurize milk. They also, in 1933, then began including produce grown in the garden and consumed as part of the revenues, right? They wanted to see how much they were saving. It wound up saving them 13% of the overall cost of food, which at that point for them was $125. I spent $145 on groceries last week. In addition to providing food for patients, the garden also became like a source of pride for people living there. There was a patient newsletter that referred to the garden and other landscape activities often. And like it became something that if you were feeling well enough to like go hang out in the garden and maybe do some gardening, they were happy to let you do, which was pretty cool. By the end of 1933, the facility had 105 beds, and those were full at all times. There was a consistent waiting list of 10 to 30 patients. Sometimes patients were crowded into smaller spaces, right? With sanatoria, even with other hospital type settings. So like here, the space was intended for 75 patients. Yes, they opened with 100 beds, but it was intended for 75 patients. So now you have 105 beds. That's a considerable amount extra. So conditions were not ideal. Things were crowded. And in fact, like, the staff was living in the main building, which didn't help. So it's even more crowded than really the 105 beds. So administrators made a really strong case to get funds allocated to construct an employee's dormitory, which helped with the crowding. So the dormitory for help, also referred to as the nurse's dormitory or just the dormitory, was completed in 1934, and then staff were housed there from that point forward. Again, like, you had to be self-sufficient once you were around tuberculosis. It became a thing where there was a lot of stigma, and so people would just live in the area they were treating patients, right? Doctors never saw like their extended family again or things like that, because they were so focused not only on helping these patients, but then their extended family was like, I don't really want to see you, you're covered in tuberculosis germs, like and this is part of how places tended to grow to be self-sufficient, right? Like, if it's not just patients stuck there 24/7, if it's also doctors and nurses who, like, want to do other things with their time, you know, they might want to garden. Like, having those extracurriculars, for lack of a better word, wasn't just for the patients. It was for the providers, too. This was stressful. You knew that most of these people you were working with and trying to help would probably die. And not great deaths either. So having things to help rejuvenate and relax was really important. So staff moving from the sanatorium actually rose the bed capacity to 140 during the 1934-1935 fiscal year. And of course, they were all immediately taken up. There was also some change to the topography of the site. So there was a large stone retaining wall added to the south of the dormitory. There were new roads and paths constructed to make like going back and forth between the main building and the dormitory easier, things like that. New water features were added to help with healing. So south of the dormitory, there was a little lakey pondy thing there that they called lovingly Sputum Lake or Sputum Pond. I'll tell you about what that is. So it had a cute little bridge too that crossed over it. The patient newsletter records the construction of the pond in 1939 and the origin of the name Sputum Lake. Apparently, the patients were curious about construction activities and watched closely as this was constructed. They joked that it would be filled with sputum and named it Sputum Lake. So that's just what it's named. Sputum, of course, is like snot. In case you didn't know, which is kind of gross, but should be sputum swamp, really. Anyway, there were more additions in 1939, so an access road, a fence, an area for raising hogs, And then they use the hogs as a kitchen waste disposal system, which is so Flintstones. Oh, I love it. They brought in a chicken coop, so there were fresh eggs. They brought in beehives, so fresh honey. Although the beehives and some like outer buildings and things like that didn't happen until about 1948. Still, this was a considerable amount of upkeep and growth for the grounds of the sanatorium. The northern part of the property is where they kind of like tossed trash, but it was more like bottles, broken crock pots, old bricks, that kind of stuff. It was a really good cost saving measure because it just costs a lot to like dispose of that kind of stuff because things break every day, right? There's a stone quarry to the west of the sanatorium during the period of time it operated in. So there's like possibly a bedrock cave system under the property, which is part of lore. And that's not likely. It's really not possible because the cave system wouldn't form in the type of bedrock that's there. But, you know, people like to think of things. Within a year of opening the dormitory, the superintendent urged the county to improve the reliability of the supply of electricity and water at the institution. So, to address water, they installed a 300-foot deep well, an elevated reserve water tank, and a water utility building in 1938. By 1940, a new pump house was constructed. The original power generator for the facility was constructed the same time as like the main building did not include a backup system. So when boilers were turned off for maintenance or repairs or they went down, electricity and heat just went away, which is not great, especially if you're in the middle of an operation. So that was a problem. Daily schedules for patients during this time included outdoor exercise prescribed on the level of wellness they were at. So, like, here's some examples from a guidebook around tuberculosis. Exercise is not prescribed for indulgence nor as a special reward. It is an essential part of your treatment and it must be taken as such. All exercise should be taken at a slow, leisurely rate. Violent exercise, such as running and jumping, is injurious to you. Never let yourself get out of breath or become fatigued unless instructed by the physician to ignore fatigue or breathlessness. Activity will be assigned by number as follows. 1. Strict bed rest. You may sit up in bed for meals and washing only. Reading and letter writing are to be done lying down. Patients would eventually build up to like bathroom privileges and eating in the dining room and then outdoor exercise in a phased manner. So like you'd get 15 minutes twice daily, increasing to 30 to 45 to an hour. And then once you got to an hour, club and rehabilitation activities, including croquet in the summer, can be substituted as part of the regular outdoor exercise. In 1948, a residential property adjacent to the sanatorium near maintenance facilities was purchased to be the home of the associate medical director. The addition of that facility enabled him and his family to live together very close to the institution, which was helpful. Sometime during the later years of the operation, a superintendent constructed an ice skating rink for his daughters in the woods near the water tower. They leveled an oval area on top of the hill, using soils from the inside of the oval to create berms around the rink. So, almost like a mound, right? The area was mown and kept clear until the 1980s, when woodland species what is with my mouth today? Woodland species began to encroach upon it. A 1997 survey identified the feature as a possible burial site or Native American earthwork area. However, the 2008 archaeological survey determined it was constructed much more recently. So there were thoughts it was on an ancient Indian burial ground. Woo! But no. Throughout the years of the operation of the sanatorium, you know, they began to see a decline in patients. Surprise! Really, 1953 was the first year that began to steadily decline. They started housing fewer patients than their capacity. And in 53, only 95 of the 140 beds were occupied on a regular basis. The standby electrical plant that was finally completed during that year was able to provide the backup source of power for emergencies, but there weren't many to have. The hog farm was disbanded in 55. And part of that was, like, it was difficult to justify the upkeep of the hogs when you didn't have as many people there. But also, City of Madison regulations. The property was annexed into the City of Madison in 1953, and you can't, like, keep livestock. So, in 1956, the number of occupied beds had dwindled to 60. The number rose the following year when the state sanatorium in Milwaukee closed and those patients were moved to Lakeview. In 1958, the fourth floor of the sanatorium was converted into a general hospital, the first Dane County General Hospital. The facility was really used for bedridden patients who needed extra attention. By 1961, the facility started accepting kids again, and they added a tutoring program to help kids who were missing school. And for the next several years, they weren't sure whether they should keep this open. The number of patients kept decreasing. There were concerns around a possible increase in rural areas, and they were worried that if they didn't keep the sanatorium open, those patients would go to other facilities that weren't sanatoria and infect people who didn't need to be infected. But it was determined in 1965 that Dane County could find another use for the building. So by January of 65, they moved the hospital that was on the fourth floor. And in 1966, they closed the sanatorium. With that closed, the administration of the property was shifted to my lovely people, the Department of Health and Human Services, the Department of Public Works, and Dane County Parks. So this is all Dane County specific, not actually the state. So it's not actually my people, but my adjacent people, my county level people. Since that time, the main sanatorium building has been used by the Department of Health and Human Services for administrative offices. In 1981, the northern 22.5 acres of the site were designed as, or were designated as, the Lakeview Woods Nature Conservancy to preserve one of the last hilltops in Madison from, like, development of more luxury apartments we don't need and can't afford. The Dane County Parks and Open Space Plan was amended in 1983 to include the southern portion of the property as an urban green space. Also that year, the 46-acre property was listed on the National Register of Historic Places for its significance related to the treatment of tuberculosis in Dane County. The Dane County Board amended the 2001-2005 Parks and Open Space Plan to include Lakeview Hill as a recreation park in 2004, and the park was placed under the jurisdiction of the Dane County Parks Commission in 2005. Also that year, 2.34 acres of the Esch family property were donated to the County Parks Commission as an addition to the park. One person shared the following anecdote, which I thought was fun. My family owned the farm where the sanatorium is now. My great-great-grandfather was a farmer and shot himself on the land. Okay, that part wasn't fun. I found the old farmer sighting interesting. There is one. As it's probably him. My grandmother is also buried in the cemetery along with all my relatives who came here from Germany. All of this land was the Sachsen farm for a long time, and they also built the little church. While I can't fully substantiate this claim based on research, the Sachsen family actually owns several farms in the area, and the sanatorium is 1.3 miles away from a house built in 1852 on one of the family farms that's still standing at 2215 North Sherman Avenue. So that's cool. And it was known to be farmland before being purchased for the sanatorium. Now, it's clear that this farmland wasn't directly purchased from the family. I think it was sold to somebody else first. That harbor dude. But it's kind of cool. So now, the moment we've all been waiting for, this entire time, spooky things. Yes, there is a farmer sighting. That's all I know about it. There's one. The main building, if you haven't seen it, it's very interesting. It's, again, up on top of this really big hill, and it kind of looks creepy. The woods behind it, there's the small graveyard behind it, those have the reputation for the most paranormal activity. There are a lot of cold and hot spots, apparitions, strange lights, odd mists, and physical manifestations, such as being touched by phantom hands. Those kinds of things are common on the trails that are woven through the park and in the graveyard. People who've walked through here report hearing voices, especially low-toned voices, and capturing recordings, which range from random noises that are hard to make out to cries for help or being told to get out of there. There are also feelings of being stalked, slapped, having your hair pulled, seeing red eyes, which could be explained away by animals, and other unexplained occurrences. The abandoned dormitory building was demolished in recent years, from what I can tell, but was a source of much spookiness. Many windows were missing, and it was clearly out of use. It had been used for some time by Health and Human Services, but, you know, at one point just wasn't easy for them to use anymore. Lights were left on, there were red lit exit signs, so just like added to the eerie feeling of like an abandoned building. And there's supposedly an apparition at the door to this building that people thought was like a nun or something who like came there to be a nurse and got sick herself. I don't know. I don't know where the nuns come in because it was nurses, but... In the woods, there are also ruins of what is rumored to be a crematorium. Let's talk about this. There's a large depression over a spot that used to be an underground tunnel that housed the dead. This is due to the fact that, like, cremations only happen, like, once a week or so, and they didn't want to diminish air quality for the patients, and blah, 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 blah. Others believe they stumble across some foundation to a torn down building, something they assume must have been nefarious, like a crematorium. I don't know why that's nefarious, but hey. This is actually likely the retaining wall that was built on the property. I found nothing about a crematorium. So, paranormal beliefs aside, the grounds are really a lovely example of Madison's dedication to natural spaces. It's a great area for a nice walk. Dogs are allowed in the park, but they have to stay on the leash. Do not let your doggos run free. As winter approaches too, this is actually a major sledding hill. So if you like sledding, boy howdy. Come here when there's not coronavirus. Because that is a great hill for sledding and tubing. The park does close at 10 p.m. And since there are state services in the main building, it is subject to routine visits from like security personnel. So don't be a dick, please. If you're lucky, too, you might even see sandhill cranes through the park. There's two couples of sandhill cranes that live in the area, and they adore kind of moving from the lake through some fields and then over to the hill throughout the day. So depending on where you're at, you can see them, talk to them. They're my pals. I miss living over by them because, like, it was really fun to, like, wake up in the morning to their prehistoric dinosaur sounds. Like, if you have never heard a sandhill crane make a noise, let's see, I'm gonna just pull it up on my phone because it is just the coolest noise. Okay. Like, I'm sorry, but I miss waking up in Jurassic Park. It's a delightful area. Again, just be smart, be safe. I hope you enjoyed your audio tour of the Lakeview Sanatorium. I pulled a lot of this from the Dane County Parks 2011 report about the sanatorium, as well as some other spots like the Historical Society, but I will put all of that in the show notes. Let's see what else. I don't know what my next episode is gonna be. I will be honest and say I don't know for sure when it's going to be. My hope is that it is soon. My hope is that the election goes smoothly. The hopeful exchange of power goes smoothly, and I will feel much more like being able to dedicate time to this instead of existential angst all the time. Anyway, I need to record a new outro too because I am going by a new name. I'm using the name Grayson more often than Kirsten. It's not that I don't like the name Kirsten. It's just like a sweater that fit me okay as a kid and it doesn't fit anymore and I need to trade it in for like a sweater that fits me. So I like that analogy. Whatever happens today, please take care of yourself. Find time to do some self-care things. Find time to take a deep breath. Make a contingency plan based on any concerns you have of violence erupting in your area. And, you know, hang in there. If you are listening to this on election day and you're concerned, I would encourage you to reach out to friends. I know that my closest friends and partners, we are hopping on like a Zoom call later to distract ourselves. And other people are playing board games or Among Us, which is delightful, or things like that. So, you know, just consider taking time to revel in connection and friendship and love if you are like me concerned about how this is gonna go. And with that, I shall bid you adieu until next time.
You just listened to the Spooky Scotty podcast. It's produced every 2 weeks by me, Kirsten Schultz. The intro outro music is from Purple Plant. You can find show notes and more over at spookyscani.podbean.com, including a transcript in case you missed anything. Take a minute and rate and subscribe if you can. You'll help more people see the show by rating, and you won't miss a single episode if you subscribe. And that's pretty dope. You can support the show over at patreon.com/spookyscanipodcast, and you can email me anything you'd like me to know at spookyscanipodcast@gmail.com. In the meantime, sleep tight and don't let the badgers bite.